Thank you very much, Stanley, because you seem to be all over. And I know you paint aquarelle. I saw some. I know also that you were somehow involved in the spoken words scene.
You're talking about an older part of my career, because for many years in New York, I was connected to the art scene, the poetry scene. And so in those days, I did have a career as a fine artist. I was on, I designed a famous art magazine called Bomb. I was on the board of directors for 15 years. I designed the magazine for 9 years at its beginning when it was first starting. So I designed the first 30-odd issues of this magazine, which is still in existence. But the bulk of my work has actually been in international brands. And that's what's paid the bills all these years. Art is not profitable for everybody. And in my case, I got to the point where it maybe was filling in about 30% of my income, but it just wasn't enough. So I left a visible career as an artist to, and I found actually, having done that, that it improved the quality of the work, not creating art for the marketplace. But at that point, I went more in the direction of international branding and international brand consulting, advising to make money, which I lived. Watercolors you've seen are more of a way of doing something, remembering a place that I visited, because in my work I did a lot of traveling, but I always felt like a photograph was a little too easy. Whereas if you paint a little aquarelle, if you bring a little tiny little watercolor kit as big as a paperback book and a little pad of paper, a little notebook of aquarelle paper, and you have the time to study a scene in more detail, in many ways you can drink in a lot more of what's there. And so I painted these aquarelles mostly to remember things for myself, to just appreciate where I was. And they're fun, and they're nice to go back to. Many of the places that I painted, I don't remember anymore. I have only the aquarelle to remind me. These days, I'm doing several things. I'm still doing the brand advisory. I work with an office in Zurich that could be the finest traditional graphic design company in the world, working in the international style, Gottschalk and Asch. I'm their brand advisor. To describe in layperson's terms what I do is difficult, because I might have a role in meeting with a client and understanding what they need, and they could need anything from a new brand identity to figuring out exactly who they are and what they stand for, and then advising in how to turn that into a public presentation, a communication strategy, a visual design strategy. I might work with lawyers, I might work with graphic designers, I might work with marketing people, I might work with an advertising agency. There's so many different parts of a project like that, because when you work on the strategic level, you're working pretty high up decision making. You're not really a foot soldier on the ground pounding out things on a computer screen. You're much more strategy driven than task driven. In the last few years, I've worked on a variety of projects for a variety of clients, everything from very well-known Swiss private bank, internationally known, the rebranding of that bank, and then additional work on that. I work with hospitality, with a foundation. Work mostly with international companies. Don't work with individual companies, local, regional, small. The scale is much larger. I was a I was a judge or a juror on the competition for the city brand of Lugano, Switzerland, for example. That was something I worked on. But funny things will walk in the door. It might be something as strange as, like, for our mutual friend Witt, I did packaging for him for his audio CDs, poetry CD. That was a labor of love that came from the heart for a friend. I'm now working on the website design for my partner, Paula Sweet. And her work is so multifaceted that it's not just designing a website. It's helping to actualize her life work and career work in a new platform. I write novels, Luca. I write travel writing. I work as the travel editor for a fashion magazine out of New Zealand. We travel a lot. I do speaking. I go out on the road and I give speeches or presentations. And if someone needs some kind of advice on a brand, they call me and I might sit down for a day with a group of executives, say, tell me about your project. More recently, I worked on a very strange, like, biotech kind of project where they were in expansion mode. They were getting bigger. They were acquiring companies. They had a lot of money to buy ancillary companies and expand their footprint globally. But they needed to distinguish themselves from the competition. And so I did something very unconventional for them. I changed the tone of voice. It wasn't that standard technical language that a lot of presentations do. It was more, much more poetic language. It's a very unusual way of working with a company. I think that's pretty much what I do.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds very plural, indeed. I mean, I remember that, you were writing a lot for travel. So looks like there is poetry, there is visual. And by the way, I discovered lately, speaking of visual, that you knew Dr. John.
Yes, that's correct. Yes. I met him 50 years ago. I was 20 and he was 27 at the time. And I was working in Los Angeles in the entertainment industry. I was working for a terrible little record company run by a near reptile by the name of Charlie Green, who had managed to rip off a number of very famous artists and was then in the process of ripping off both Dr. John and myself. That's how that turned out.
It's a common practice, I think, in this field.
I think so. And the music business in those days was just a cesspool of corruption. And Charlie Green was the embodiment of it. I met a lot of corrupt people in my life, but I think, you know, he was the first big one that I really got a close look at. And at the end of the year that I spent with him designing album covers, working with his recording artists, I saw a tremendous amount of corruption. And at the end of it, just barely 21 years old at the end of that year, he left me with, he ran up a lot of debts under my name, and I found myself facing bills at the time, which just seemed like an unthinkable amount of money for a 20-year-old poor boy from the east side of Los Angeles like myself. It's like $700 of debt I was looking. That was a staggering amount of money to suddenly be held responsible for, was essentially paying somebody else's way. And he was working with Dr. John at the time. So I used to see Mac in the office a lot.
Mac is his real name, in fact.
Mac is his real name. Malcolm John Rebenack Jr. is his name. I used to see Mac in the office. He had other business with Charlie, which is they were making what were called demo tapes. A demo tape is a recording artist goes into the recording studio, sings the song and plays the song, a very essential voice track and rhythm track, and Mac would play the piano and sing, and they would have a lead sheet, a chart made for it of the music and words, and that would be used to file the copyright. It'd be also the way that you would in those days shop the tune around to other artists and record companies and say, record these tunes. And Charlie Green was very adept at getting people to sign ridiculous, extortionate contracts for the publishing rights. You know, I'm not fully aware of how music contracts are written today, but in those days there was publishing, which was writer share, and then the publishing company share took a share. And then if it was recorded, there was the artist share for the artist performance. And then there would be the broadcast royalties, performance royalties. Charlie Green, he took everything and gave nothing. In fact, a song that I wrote with Mac that he recorded one night.
Oh, you wrote a song?
I wrote the song. I had a terrible breakup with a terrible girlfriend, whose last name was Hurt, by the way, H-U-R-T. She was beautifully named. And I played the song for Charlie, and he said, "Oh, I'm going to sign you to a publishing contract, Stanley." And he pulls out a standard contract, just a sign here, and essentially, you know, signed me to an ironclad contract where he owned the lion's share, 51% of the copyright and 51% of the writer royalty. And Mac recorded it one night. They took the lead sheet in, and Mac was running through songs and recording these demo tapes. I thought nothing of it. And especially when the end of the year with Charlie was done and I was leaving him in his office, and the last thing he said to me is, "Can I have Mean Cheating Woman?" And I said, "No." I said, "I wrote that song. Why would I leave it with you? What do I owe you?" Anyway, years later, Charlie fell on hard times. And he took these demo tapes. The way it was generally done was the artist would run through the song and the lyric two times. And then they would cut one time, and that would be the recording that would be sent out to other artists to say, "Why don't you record this song?" It came to Mac's attention. Mac said, I was talking to him one day, and he said to me, "Stanley," he said, "you know that song of yours, Charlie Green sold it out to somebody else?" He sold the song to another scabrous music publisher out of Las Vegas by the name of Charlie Underwood, and then he added horns and background voices to it and released it as a single, which I had no idea about. So I immediately filed the copyright. Charlie, of course, had never filed the copyright. So I filed the copyright in my own name. I own the copyright on the song. And then I went to the Performance Rights Society, which is BMI. And every quarter I get a little check for, I think the most recent one was $4.50 for performance royalties on Mean Cheating Woman. But yes, Mac Rebennack cut one of my songs, which suddenly showed up on an album. And now this Underwood fellow has licensed it all over the world. Now the royalty statement is everything, you know, YouTube and Napster and all these other online music, including Apple Tunes, you know. So I get a minuscule, microscopic royalty to this day for that song.
Oh, wow. What's the name of the song?
Mean Cheating Woman.
Okay, I'll try to find it.
Oh, you can find it. In fact, I posted on the YouTube versions of it, the real story of the song as a comment. But one of the things that I really did discover in the time and by the way, this was also the era where I designed the album cover for Dr. John, the first one of four that I did, this one called Remedies, which was the first album cover I did of his. And
Remedies, that's the name of the album.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the year is 1969. Anyway, and we stayed friends. We stayed in touch, Mac Rebennack and I. But one of the things that I very quickly discovered was that it was extremely cool to be in the same room as Dr. John when he was seated at a piano, because he could play anything, you know? He could play, he would have been like perfect in remember this pianist that used to play music during the silent movies, and there would be an action scene, and they would play the William Tell Overture with the horses riding, and there would be a romantic scene, and they would play some romantic music. Mac could do that, and you could tell him a story just to entertain ourselves. I mean, you know, we were all stoned at the time anyway, but you could tell a story like that, and he would play the theme music. He'd play anything, Rhapsody in Blue and Barrel House Boogie Woogie, and then the next thing he'd be playing would be Fats Domino riffs. And he was incredibly versatile.
This is how he started, for what I read. He was playing this long time, I think it was New Orleans, where he had to play for 7-10 hours, and then you would have to go, for example, if one of the musicians have to go eat or to the toilet, he would have to take that instrument and play it. That's why he played also lots of instruments, for what I read.
Well, he had a reputation at the beginning as a guitarist, as a guitar player. He had a very funky style. I know you as a musician understand that funky means, the best way to describe it is that you're ever so microscopically behind the beat, always. You're a little bit behind the beat. And very few musicians can execute that. It's a hallmark of the New Orleans style. Like, you listen to Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton is not funky. He's very, very able and agile. He knows his riffs and all of that, but he is right on the money. He's a very skilled musician. Well, Mac Rebennack was very funky, and he always was perfect behind the beat. Anyway, he got into some kind of a struggle because he was a heroin addict at the time, and a lot of his other time was spent, you know, trying to find drugs. And so he was a bit involved with the underworld, and at one point he got into struggling with somebody over something and got a bullet wound through one of his fingers. He didn't lose the finger, but it was mal-shaped. There's a photograph of his hands that I took for one of the other album covers that I did for him, Creole Moon. Creole Moon has a picture of Dr. John's hands, and you can see that one of the fingers is misshapen. But that limited his ability to play as a guitar player. He came to L.A. to be Sam Cooke's guitar player, but then Sam Cooke got killed in an airplane crash. Mac got into sort of the L.A. drug scene, though he was always very well valued as a sideman, as a studio musician, but he became known for his piano style, and that became his instrument of choice for the next 40-odd years, until the end of his career.
So what was your relationship with it?
Mostly friends. Okay. I mean, we were, you see, at first we were both young people working for this awful guy. He was 27 and I was 20. And I was working on his album cover.
How many records did you do the cover?
I did 4 covers for him over the course of 50 years.
Which one?
The first one was Remedies. Then the next one was Creole Moon, which is much later. And then the other one, the one that followed that, was the Duke Ellington covers, which I did with the Plasm Design Studio. They were the designers, and I was sort of the concept facilitator guy. I worked with Mac and his people, the record company and the design company, back and forth, helping to refine the concepts. And also, I was the ghostwriter. I ghostwrote his letter that's on that album cover. I ghostwrote all of the text on the Creole Moon covers. And then the last album cover that I did with him was called New Orleans Dis Dat and Da Utta. And that was a disaster. And the reason it was a disaster was that he was involved with an unscrupulous manager who got involved with the album design. And then Mac also was married to a woman who got involved with the design aspect. And she had opinions too. And so design by committee never works, no matter who you're working with. It could be a beverage company, or it could be a recording artist. But you'll never get a really pure design by having a bunch of people vote on it. Design really doesn't want to be democratic. I think it wants to be a little more individual. Anyway, that album cover was a disaster. I'll tell you what happened, which is they began saying, well, we don't like this cover. And so I did something that in my career, I mean, I started work when I was 15 years old. I'm 70 now. So I've been doing graphic design and brand strategy for 55 years. So this was about 10, 12 years ago. And I did the thing that you shouldn't ever do, which is I kept sending revised designs. I must have sent 20 different album covers, and every time they found something they didn't like. Now, I'm much more qualified than they are to make design decisions. Also, they changed their mind, and also the wife didn't really know what she was doing. Anyway, that's the fourth album cover, Distat and Da'ada. And on that, Mac had kind of disinvolved himself from. So there's one more Dr. John album which is supposed to be released, the posthumous one. It's in the can, and I'm going to make some effort to see if I can design the fifth Dr. John cover of my career, the posthumous one. I don't know whether it's possible. I think that, you know, his last few album covers have been very, very glamorous commercial packages from commercial record companies. But I would like to design the last packet. I don't know whether that's possible.
So it was a good friend of yours then?
He was a dear friend of mine. And we did a lot of hanging out. I was the best man at that last wedding. We went down to see, and I stood up for my friend, and then, you know, the wedding dinner and all of that. He knew me from since I was 20 until now. I mean, we were in contact in the month before he died. We had some contact. Actually, it was about Mean Cheating Woman, where I sent in the little story that I published about it. And yes, I know him and I know his children. Wherever I was, we saw each other. Wherever he was, where we were in the same place, we saw each other. He knows my daughter. My daughter used to walk down to, when he lived in the East 30s in New York and I was living there, I would walk down to his house and hang out. And I would bring my baby daughter. My daughter was no more than about 3. He would take her on his lap, and he'd be at the keyboard, and she'd say, Mac, play the Big Chiefs, and he'd play and sing for her. And there's some very cool photographs of her as a little girl, a little baby sitting on his lap and things like that. So we had a very close personal relationship. When we were in L.A., I remember once we were going, all of us and our girlfriends were going away for some weekend, and I stopped at my mother's house, and Dr. John sat down at the kitchen table and talked with my mother. And when my mom passed away, I told Mac, because he would want to know. He had a very kind recollection of her. So it was a deep, affectionate, personal friendship. When he would come to Portland, Oregon, in the years that I was living there, he would always have a dinner at our house, and then we'd always go out for oysters, because they're very well known for oysters. And he could eat 100 at a time. He was a man of voracious appetites when it came to oysters. So he didn't drink. Mac Rebenek did not drink alcohol. After he got clean, he did not use any drugs either. So he might puff a little reefer, but that nothing, no hard drugs. He was clean and sober. And it's really difficult being famous and being recognized. I mean, I know you know that because you know lots of high-visibility famous people. But being Dr. John must have been really difficult. I know because I would sit in a dressing room with him, and people would come to the door, and they'd come up to him, and they'd say, oh, yeah, man, I saw you in Shreveport in 1965. I came to the dressing room, and you signed my album cover. And Mac was always very polite about that. He was always very gracious. He'd say, oh, yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, that was a great concert. But he was working 300 days a year at one point. So I think that a lot of the people introduced themselves to him didn't really remember, but he was gracious enough to acknowledge. But it was very hard because everybody, when you're famous, everybody wants something from you. And that I observed firsthand with him. so that when I would go hang out with him in the dressing room before a gig, a lot of the time I'd just sit there. He'd just sit there. We'd just be nodding at each other. Or we might recollect some people we knew. Or I'll tell you another thing. I mean, this is how close we were as friends, is sometimes he'd say, I got to get to the barber, Stanley. And I say, well, all right, I'll bring my scissors. I'll bring a barbering tool. So, like for the Creole Moon album cover, I did the barbering of Dr. John for that, you know, for the photo session, that kind of thing. A lot of what your role becomes when you're close to a person with that kind of visibility is you become a barrier between them and the public. You become a buffer for them. And that's a lot of what I did with Mac Rebenack when we'd be out in public, is I would catch the flack. If somebody wanted an album cover signed, they hand you the album cover with a piece of paper, and then you carry it to him in the dressing room. So a lot of our relationship in later times was more just hanging out together and my not wanting anything. I don't have in my possession a Dr. John autograph. He never autographed anything to me. I've got photos of when we met, you know, and I've got the very nice photo from 1968 or 1969, that really nice photo of both of us as young guys. And I have those odd pictures that are taken when you go to a gig. Somebody wants to take a picture of you standing next to them. But my artifact about our friendship is more here. Memories. Once in L.A., he had to go to a doctor. I was there. I said, well, I'll drive you. So we had a nice ride from Hollywood down to the beach area where the doctor was. And I just hung out. And then he had his appointment. And then we had the drive back. And that was really an opportunity to have a very good conversation, a very down-to-earth, heart-to-heart talk. But at that point, it was recollection, you know. Really, we were just sort of remembering how strange it was to be in Hollywood in those days, how curious it was to be in the music business. But I saw him in London 1 year. I saw him in L.A. a number of times. I saw him in Portland a number of times because I was living there. I saw him in New York a lot because we both were living there. He played a concert for my 41st birthday in New York City. He needed a design for a T-shirt, so I traded the design for the T-shirt for a birthday concert. And then once he played a concert for BOM magazine as a benefit for BOM, so I was able to call in that favor and arrange that concert. And then took him and a whole party of people out to dinner at a restaurant where I had a relationship. And, you know, there were some pretty interesting people at that concert. David Byrne from the Talking Heads was there. And some artists whose names you would know now, painters, sculptor kind of people, who were at that private concert. That was an amazing event because there couldn't have been more than 30, 40 people in an elegant Soho loft with a grand piano. So Dr. John, acoustic, grand piano, and room full of very privileged, creative people. That was a remarkable event. The birthday party was great, too, because he said, you know, I can dedicate some songs if you want. So I said, well, give me your playlist. And he gave me his playlist. And then I said, well, could you sing this? Could you sing a dedication for all this person and that person? And so all of the people in my birthday concert had songs dedicated to them, which was pretty cool. I have a lot of very happy memories like that.
What's your view on his music? How will you describe it? Not only how you will describe it, but how you feel it. I mean, because he has this background where he learned with Hound, if I'm not mistaken, and then he went through this New Orleans.
Played with Professor Longhair and Huey Smith. He knew all those people and everybody else. my view on his music is that it was grounded in the traditions of the New Orleans sound very much. He really started in rhythm and blues, and he transited the blues, rock, jazz, and that hybrid category of sort of voodoo rock that he almost created himself. So that when he played the music of other people, like Fats Domino or Buddy Bolin, he's got that wonderful album called Going Back to New Orleans, which is a celebration of all of the New Orleans traditional musics that influenced him. It starts with Gottschalk. It's got Buddy Bolin. It's got Louis Armstrong. And he was emphatic about Louis Armstrong. He said, don't call him Louis. We never called him Louis. We always called him Louis Stanley. So, you know, he was quite emphatic about being true to his traditions. And he could play spiritual, he could play gospel. I mean, and you and there's a very nice video of him playing When the Saints Go Marching In, which is usually a rousing, marching, kind of honking, almost polka-like number. He plays it like a mournful, in the minor key, kind of slow and thoughtful. Toward the end of his career, that is in the last 20 years, he began to do cover records. He began to do other people's material. He did the Duke Ellington one. He did one of Johnny Mercer's songs. And then he did collaborations. He liked collaborating, you know. He was a band musician as much as he was a solo artist. But he liked bouncing off of other people. My feeling about his music is I always preferred the things that were more along the lines of traditional. I think that as he, sometimes the more recent compositions that he did didn't really add anything to the canon. I think he was writing just because writing is such a compulsive act. It's like looking at some early paintings by Rembrandt that are so inspired. You can see the quotient of interest in them. And then the later or the middle ones are, they were done for money, essentially. They were what we call potboilers, you know, in English. And I think that a lot of Max later, he enjoyed writing. He wrote with Doc Pomus. He wrote a lot of very interesting songs with Doc Pomus. And he did collaborations. He did collaborations with Ricky Lee Jones. The Makin' Whoopee record is very well regarded. He did a Christmas record with Leon Redbone. So you asked me how I feel about his music. Well, I think that the Grigri music that he started with was innocent and inventive. And I love that early stuff. And also that's how I discovered him, because I knew who he was before I went to work at Charlie Green's office. I knew that first album, Grigri, where this strange character called Dr. John was singing voodoo songs and strange fusion rock and roll. So I love that stuff. And I love anything where he channeled the tradition of New Orleans. That for me also was really wonderful. And I liked a lot of the way that he reinterpreted traditional music from New Orleans. And remember, I've had the privilege of sitting in a room, sitting next to him as he was at a piano, and watch him play and sing and improvise. That's a remarkable thing to be a party to genius. It's like many years ago I had the opportunity to be in a room when an operatic singer, a baritone, was practicing for a major performance. And I sat in a row in front of this human being and witnessed what humans can generate on totally on themselves, not a recording. A live performance with an artist of the magnitude of Mac Revenack is it can't be described. You can only say you're witnessing something celestial, magical. And those were some of the greatest moments that I spent with him. One night we invited him for dinner in Portland, and you know, I knew that he was on the road, he was eating restaurant food, he was being hustled here and there in vehicles and having airplanes and having people asking him questions for interviews. The artist's life is not a pretty one. It's people wanting something from you all the time. So I said to my partner, woman I was living with in Portland, I said, no pressure on Mac when he gets here. You let him just sit down. He wants to smoke a cigarette, let him smoke a cigarette. He wants to stand by the window, let him stand by the window. We'll set the table, we'll have our dinner, and then we'll go to the gig, because he was playing the Portland Blues Festival. Well, he walked into the apartment, kind of looked around, you know, greetings, kisses, and he looks at the piano and he says, can I play? Can I play that? Says, yeah, sure. Dr. John sits down at the piano in the living room and begins to play. And he played until dinner time while we were cooking in the kitchen to the background of Dr. John playing the blues on the piano in the living room. We were preparing the dinner and setting the table in our home. You can't buy an experience like that. But that's the kind of affectionate memory I have of Mac. So, I don't know, your original question was about what do I think of the music? I think that the traditional music, the music that he created very early on, the genre that he invented, the recreations that he did are the ones that really move me the most. And the more contrived stuff, it's played by the master and sung by the master. And he had excellent phrasing, of course. He had excellent timing, both musically and vocally. A song has to have some kind of a depth and soul to it. And many, many of the later ones did. And many of them were filler. You know, he got involved at some point in the hurricane relief, like the Bluesiana album. And a lot of those songs were supposed to dramatize the plight of people who suffered after the hurricane damage. So those were songs that were kind of politically themed. But there are very few songs in history of political themes that come forward. And there was a lot of them. You know, the Marseillaise, the Internazionale. I mean, very few songs like that carry forward. We don't have that many of them. And then I think there's songs that have some kind of a universal meaning, like When the Saints Go Marching In. A song like that, it speaks to everyone. And then the one that they played when they did the second line for him in New Orleans after he died, the Stephen Foster song, that for me was quite a moment, because it was the song that they chose to honor him. And it was a very traditional American composer singing a song that was 180 years old. They sang, and they also sang Lay My Burden Down, you know, Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, When I Lay My Burden Down. And that was one that he recorded. He recorded it on the Going Back to New Orleans album. And he did a very nice version of that with Mavis Staples. Lovely, just lovely. Listen, you know, it's a blessing to have a friendship like that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Is there a song or an album or not only that you like a lot, but that you would associate with them and say, oh, that song, that's, if you listen to that song, take you straight to your travels between Hollywood and the beach of Hollywood, or Long Island?
Well, look, he recorded a lot of really interesting songs. One of them, my grandfather used to sing to me when I was a little boy. Basin Street Blues. That's on Going Back to New Orleans. And when I hear his version of that, it's very personal. It's a very personal song. I think that one, and that's a traditional. I mean, I don't even know if it's known who wrote it. I'm not sure, you know. I mean, that's a song that goes back 100, 120 years. And there, what an interesting experience that is, if you think about it. Because here's a friend of mine who's a traditional musician. And actually, Mac Rebenek was a traditional musician. He wasn't an artificial construct. He was the real thing. He was the real deal. He channeled the people. Like, you know, in our lives, he was the primary conduit to a lot of those originators of New Orleans music. He met Longhair. He was taught by Longhair. He played with Longhair. The transmission comes from Mac to me, from me to you. From Longhair to Mac, from Mac to me, from me to you. That's what makes so much of the friendship extraordinary. My grandfather told me a story once about being in New York City and seeing the magician Houdini make an elephant vanish from the stage of Madison Square Garden. Now, as my grandfather telling me and me telling you, the transmission is really only two steps. Well, Mac Rebenek is like that. The transmission from those originators of New Orleans music to him, from him to me, or from him to the world, is a remarkable thing. You don't often meet somebody who can do that. That's the joy and the blessing of a relationship like this, is the experience of la transmission.
Thank you very much, Stanley. That's a very precious testimony of your relationship with him, and also to grab a bit of this wonderful talent that he was. And I really appreciate your time for this.
No, it's a great conversation, and you know, I can tell you there was an honor and a joy to know him as a friend, because I knew the person behind the music in a very, very personal way, very close way. So, I mean, but the music seems to have spoken to the world, much bigger world. You didn't need to know the person to reap the benefit of the music.